Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Oh. Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Hello and welcome to a Witch Please holiday special. I'm Marcel Cosman.
And I'm Hannah McGregor. And this year, our gift to you is this uber chaotic holiday funtacular episode from our original run of Witch Please. It guest stars everyone's favorite guy with a film degree, Neil Barnholden, our now actually erstwhile tech support, Trevor Chow Fraser, and some cameos from our once upon a time baby hippogriff. There might also be kitties. It's a real full cast production.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who are new listeners since the reboot, you're about to hear something a little out of the ordinary, especially for us. This is the raw, chaotic energy of a couple of amateur podcasters with no accountability to a network and no professional producer telling us to get it together.
This is one of my favorite episodes that we have ever made for the deep and profound strangeness of it.
We're also told that it's a fan favorite. And so we hope that whether you've heard it before or this is the first time, we hope that you enjoy it too.
And we hope that wherever you are and what you are doing, you are finding some ways to light up some lights in this darkest time of year. And may this extremely silly podcast episode be one of those lights for you.
Happy holidays and see you in 2021.
No, but seriously, Trevor, I need another drink.
Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a fortnightly podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Marcel Cosman.
I'm Hannah McGregor.
I'm Neil Barnholden.
And I'm Trevor Chow Fraser.
And this is a hippogriff baby. Okay, well, we'll hear from him later. That's right, witches. We've got the whole Witch Please family home for the holidays, and today we're going to bring you something special. A detailed book-by-book analysis of how Hogwarts celebrates the holidays, accompanied by some liberal consumption of non-dairy eggnog-like beverage and a few jingle bell sound effects.
Ching, 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 ching. Oh, wait. No, I have dialogue.
Yeah.
But before we start what will surely prove to be an exhaustive analysis, let's get all our sugar plums in a row in the sorting chat. I want to start off by saying that, like, Hogwarts has this amazing aesthetic capacity to capture all of my most, like, Dickensian Christmas fantasies. Like, there's something about the pre-existing setting of Hogwarts that makes it
feel extra special Christmassy.
No, I hear what you're saying. It reminds me of in versions of A Christmas Carol when they do Christmas past, right? The previous Christmases where everyone is having a good time and they're all quite drunk. But I mean, it's Dickens, so it's not too surprising. But yeah, there's something about that kind of warmth, that things are festooned with things.
Yes,
it's so good, yeah.
Lots
and the ghosts. You're thinking of the ghosts, obviously.
Yeah, also the fact that it is haunted. Haunted.
Like any true Christmas story, Trevor says. There's also a lot of candles, which you can't really do in real life without burning shit down. But in a magical world, it can be all candles all the time.
Oh, yeah. Like every time I try to float candles in the air, they just like fall down and spill wax all over the place. And like Hanukkah's ruined.
So we often like to set the scene
for
where we're recording. So we're actually recording this in the home of Marcel and Trevor and baby Hippogriff and several cats. It is the home of several cats.
Wow.
It is lovely. It's very festive in here. It's very warm. Oh, we have, guys, I'm out of rum. It's a real bummer. Okay. While I'm setting the scene, I want Trevor to make me another rum and eggnog.
Well, I'll just grab it from that cabinet that just appeared. That's like a Chow Fraser Cosman-sized liquor cabinet for sure.
Trevor, when did we get that huge cabinet? I guess I'll just open that door and see what's on the other side.
Whoa, look at that. There's something behind all of the multiple liquor bottles inside this cabinet.
Is it Narnia?
It probably is.
Guys, let's go to Narnia.
There's elfish everywhere. What's this? A dragon in its lair. What's this? I can't believe my eyes. I must be dreaming. Me, oh my, this isn't fair. What's this?
What's this? What's this? There's something very wrong. What's this? That goblin singing songs. What's this? The hills are full of elves and dwarves and hobbits out for gold and secret treasure through the mountains on adventure. What is this? What's this?
Wizards singing folk songs instead of blasting spells. They seem to live forever, unlike Nicholas Flamel. Can Gandalf really magic? He's really good with swords. Is history the real magic here? I simply can't decide.
Look, what's this? He's forged an evil ring. One ring to give to every king. Inspired, one ring to rule them all. And in the dark to him he'll bind them. Oh my gods, what's this? What's this? It's Sam. Gaze deep in Frodo's eyes. How queer. Get up that mountainside or die. If Sauron gets the Ring of Power, elves and humans all will cower and war will come to everyone. Now correct me if I'm wrong. This looks like fun. This looks like fun. Could it be I've got my wish? What's this?
Oh my. What now? The dwarves are all kaput. And look, a Balrog underfoot. Nazguls, orcs and trolls and orientals, olifants and trees. Don't start making coney stew, you'll never get to eat. Sigh. What's this?
The ministry is missing and no Death Eaters in sight. And in their place there seems to be a big red flaming eye. Instead of he who can't be named, here ringwraiths on the wing. If you want him, come and claim him. What's with this damn ring?
The sights, the sounds, they're everywhere and all around. I've never felt so good before. This empty place inside of me is filling up. I simply cannot get enough. I want it, oh I want it, oh I want it for my own. I've got to know, what is this place with so much mirth? What is this? Middle Earth? Hmm.
Hello and welcome to Tolkien Female Characters, our semi-monthly podcast about the representation of women in the works of Tolkien. I'm Hannah McGregor.
I'm Marcel Cosman.
I'm Neil Barnholden, your Tolkien male co-host.
And I'm Trevor Chow Fraser, your erstwhile armorer.
Today we bring you episode 3.7 of Tolkien Female Characters, in which we continue our discussion of the extended version of The Fellowship of the Ring.
But before we get into who wears their braids best, let's rehash our feelings about the movie in our first segment, Second Breakfast.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Like, Marcel, you should start us in here.
Should I?
This movie is so close to your heart.
This movie is so close to my heart. If I had to live on a desert island with, for some inexplicable reason, a Blu-ray player and a flat screen television and only one Blu-ray film, it would be the extended edition of The Fellowship of the Ring, because I am so into...
Trevor, try harder.
I told you he mixes them light. Because I'm more, so into... Because I am so into the...
Oh my God, burn it to the ground.
I know that we're talking about the Fellowship of the Ring, but really, the key culinary moment in the whole series comes in
it.
The next one.
Don't do it.
And
don't
I know...
You, I can't stand it. I can't stand it. Oh my God, I can't believe you brought it up. I'm still so upset that after what is probably months of traveling and eating nothing but fucking Lembas bread, Gollum gets some goddamn rabbits and Sam is going to make a brace of Coney stew and he makes this delicious looking Coney stew. And then they never get to eat it because like goddamn Faramir shows up and is like, I need to prove something to my father. So you guys are coming with me.
So we were just rewatching Fellowship of the Ring this morning and thinking through, like, I have this place in my heart for Ian McKellen's OPS. That's baby weighing in. I have this place in my heart for Sir Ian McKellen's portrayal of Gandalf that is not matched by my fondness. Like, I like Sir Ian McKellen fine, but I don't love him. And I like Gandalf in the books fine. I don't love him. But I love Gandalf in these movies. Mm-hmm. I want him to be my brother, teacher, dad, friend. Just everything. Yeah. I want to be him. Like, I would really like to be him when I grow up, if I could manage that somehow. And we were talking about how part of it is the kind of wizard that he is. Mm-hmm. That there is something, like, he's sort of a scholar wizard, right? We have that great scene of him doing research.
Yeah, I really appreciate the fact that Gandalf hits the books when he starts to suspect that something is going on with the ring. There's that whole scene of him reading the primary documents that tell the history of the ring. And I just think that's great. He really does the research. It's very exciting and interesting.
Yeah. You might say that he's not just a conjurer of some cheap conjecture. That was Neil's joke earlier. I totally just stole Neil's joke.
It's all fair game in the writing room, people.
You're just a thieving hobbit, Marcel Cosman.
True. I ain't been thieving no lines, sir.
Terrible. It's not even funny. It's not even. Never mind. It's not even. I don't know what I'm doing. I need another drink.
If we're talking about our feelings of who we'd like to grow up to be in Lord of the Rings, yeah, then like 100%, it's Strider. You know, for me, it's not even Aragorn. It's the guy who's like lost in the wilderness, completely in control of the wild. Ooh. And you know, he can see in the dark. That long, luscious, greasy hair.
Yeah, one of the really unfortunate things about this film adaptation is that we really only spend like 30 seconds with Strider, and then he turns into like descended King Aragorn, which is like not nearly as interesting or sexy, to be honest.
Yeah, one thing that I really like about the movies in particular is that they really give off the feel of a whole secondary world that's consistent in and of itself and that has this whole rich kind of world without reference to our world directly. It's all sort of allegorical.
I mean, that's because it was shot on location.
Yeah.
In the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, exactly.
In Middle Earth.
A bizarre other world that I have no experience of.
I mean, it's really expensive airfare.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I actually did really want to know why Marcel loves this movie.
I'm not joking when I say that the sweeping landscape shots I'm really into. To be honest, I think of the trilogy, The Two Towers is my favorite. So we'll talk about that when we get to the Two Towers film. But I prefer to put on the Fellowship of the Ring when I just want something in the background. Like if I need to do other things like clean the house or like, I don't know, like nurse a baby for 10 hours in a day, something like that. Like I like having the Fellowship because, first of all, it takes 10 hours and you get introduced to the majority of your major characters, which is really nice. You get to see Rivendell. You get to see Gimli and Legolas duke it out. They're not really buds yet, which is super. But I think the real reason is because I would love to live in the Shire. I think deep in my heart, like I'm a hobbit. If I was going to be a character from Lord of the Rings, I would obviously be a hobbit.
Oh yeah, me too. I really felt like I came home to fantasy as a genre when I saw the representation of hobbits. And I was like, what? There's room for short, fat people with curly hair in fantasy novels. At last.
And hairy feet.
And hairy feet. My strong fondness for eating just like really carb heavy meals. I'm very into
ale. And smoking pipeweed.
I love pipeweed. I just like to, like, on a Saturday night, all I want to do is just like sing some thumpy folk songs with my friends in a tavern. Like, it's just perfect. It's really perfect. And so Neil read out loud to us as we were prepping today this letter that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote, where he is explaining the metaphorical relationship of the Shire to the rest of the world. What was that? Do you remember it well enough to summarize it?
I could only paraphrase it, but it was essentially about how the Shire is deliberately unexciting and sort of everyday as compared to the really alluring, exciting, larger-than-life events that are taking place outside of the Shire.
That's obviously nonsense because the Shire is the most exciting part of the films, but like whatever Tolkien, like whatever your idea of
exciting is.
I would watch an entire movie set in the Shire.
And of course, as you know, here on Tolkien female characters, we're really big on authorial intent, which is why we endlessly pore over the various letters and notes that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote.
God bless you, Neil!
Grab your dragon fireworks and put on your furry feet because it's time for Conjurers of Cheap Tricks, our discussion of the special effects and film techniques of the Lord of the Rings movies. And I think that we need to start with a really urgent question that I think Trevor had, which is how do they make the hobbits smaller than humans?
How do they make the hobbits smaller than humans? That's what I want to know.
I think it's a combination of forced photography, so the camera's at a really particular angle. So
it sounds like slave labor or something.
machines. I get forced perspective is what I'm thinking of. Sorry. I mean, they also didn't they build the sets to be to the wrong scale? So the sets are actually built to make normal humans look smaller. So it's actually Ian McKellen is a bit larger than a normal person. Like he's up on a box or something? A multi-million-dollar box? I don't know.
You don't know?
What if in the darkest timeline, Neil doesn't know anything about how films work? And only the baby knows.
One of the things that I find the most impressive about these films, and especially about this first one, is the way that they so spectacularly make the size difference between two actors who are relatively similar heights seem astounding, right? Mm. Like Gandalf looks enormous and all of the hobbits look regular sized until you take the hobbits out of the Shire and then all of a sudden Gandalf is regular sized and the hobbits look like children, you know, as Aragorn says in the second movie, which we're not talking about yet. Apparently that one really is my favorite because I keep wanting to talk about what happens in that movie.
The other really notable thing about special effects in this movie is how there's a wizard battle between Gandalf and Saruman, but there's no like splashy effects of fire and like lasers blasting and explosions. It's just, it's all unseen, invisible force that they're like knocking back and forth.
Yeah.
Which is really effective. And they like, they'll get knocked down and there'll be a cut, but you can't see where it came from.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have wands.
They have staffs.
They have giant staffs. Yeah. That's like a man's wand, you know?
As you know, listeners, I'm really into like thinking about camera angles and shot lengths, sort of famously into shot lengths. One of the things that really stands out in this movie is that there are a lot of really sort of ostentatiously strange camera shots, right? Like things, there's one really important scene where Frodo and Gandalf are talking to each other, and Gandalf's face, like the camera's zoomed way in on his face and is looking at him through a chandelier, which is like a crazy choice. Or that scene where Gandalf and Saruman are talking and they're in the garden, and then the sound of their conversation continues, but the camera cuts to an empty room, and then it's like the camera has to go find them, and it has to sort of move through the halls to figure out where they are. And so there's this disjunction between the sound of their voices, which continues at regular volume, and the camera's relationship to that sound and to the location of the characters. Like, the film feels filmic. It's not at all sort of naturalistic. It's never trying to make you forget the presence of the camera. It's really like highly stylized in a way that I think is part of why, for somebody like Marcel, it endures as a pleasurable watching experience so many times.
You know what's a really good comparison is like one of those like Harry Potter movies, you know, with like the really shitty CGI. Like those just like they just don't hold up. Like the fourth one, what was the fourth one? The Goblet of Dragons. Yeah, with the like underwater scenes that are just so ugh. Yeah. God.
And those wizard battles in those movies are all people throwing entire spectral animals at each other. It's pretty weird. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. It's too much. It's over the top.
Yeah. Like I've only seen a couple of them, so I don't really remember a whole lot because I just saw them when they came out in theaters and like that's about it. But like from what I remember, they're not very good.
The other really dumb thing about those movies is that they're just not going to age well, right? Like a movie like this is, what has it been, like a decade?
It's been like 12, 13 years.
Like that's amazing because they still look like movies that could have come out last year, yeah. Right? They're still so beautiful. Yeah. Whereas one of those, like I think I watched like the second one of those, Henry Potter movies recently, and it was just like, God, this feels dated, right? Like nobody's going to want to talk about these like a year after they're done.
So it makes me really wish I'd gotten that film degree.
That's obviously where we're going to end
segment. We really let this one develop.
What's that in the distance? Is that a reindeer? Is it some sort of Hanukkah tree? I guess it's time to answer the question, what do your elf eyes see? Our segment on homoerotic tensions in Tolkien's oeuvre.
So obviously this section being named after the clear homoerotic relationship between, I mean, just Legolas and every other character who's proximate to him at any time.
Yes.
You know, that's the relationship that we spent a lot of time talking about. But I want to branch out a little bit and talk about a homoerotic relationship in the films that I don't think gets discussed much because it's buried pretty deeply. But it's Sam and Frodo. You guys notice how deeply buried that particular homoeroticism is?
I don't see it, Hannah. What are you talking about?
Okay, so like we already know that elves in the series are a metaphor for women. And so I think we need to consider first Sam's excitement and delight over the idea of going to Rivendell to see the elves, right? Like Sam really wants to see elves because he's obviously never seen a woman before. So I think what we need to do is understand first that he is a character who's only ever experienced men. And so his love is like a pure and profound love for men already. And elves, again, which are a metaphor for women, are just the sort of mystical other that he has yet to experience.
Also, I like to point out, since we really like to bring in, you know, research to this podcast, according to the end of Return of the King, Sam does come back and have an exceptional 13 children with that hobbit lady. A character who's so important that she actually only appears in that last part of Return of the King where it's explained that they had many children. So, yeah. You know, I'd just like to point out that pretty much totally refutes this whole thing.
But if we return to Tolkien's intentions with the series, I think what he really meant to do with female characters like Rosie is sort of set them up as symbols that stand against the kinds of eroticized adventuring that Sam and Frodo do throughout the rest of the movie, right? So there's this way in which the wider world is a world for men. Mm-hmm. The wider world of adventure is a world in which men move, mm-hmm. and the women obviously belong only in the domestic sphere, which is the Shire, yeah. right? And they're strongly affiliated with, you know, eating, sleeping, and begetting. What were those Tolkien's big three major life activities? Mm-hmm. And so it's also just a sign of Sam's sexual maturation, right? There's sort of this implication that being out in the world, having your sort of homosocial period of adventure is something that you get over eventually, and then you go home and you stop having fun and you beget 13 children.
This conversation actually really reminds me of one of the things that Peter Jackson's adaptations do that really trouble me. And what he does is he seems to try to empower the female characters from Tolkien's books. So like Arwen is the best example of this, because Arwen shows up unaccompanied on a horse out looking for her lover. And when she finds them, Frodo is in need of help. So she then takes him back to Rivendell because we're supposed to believe that she's the faster rider. Like she's supposed to ride faster than Aragorn. But so in the books, that's her father, which makes infinitely more sense, right? Like it makes so much more sense that he would be out riding around while she was at home waiting for this man who she loves to like come and visit her on occasion or like whatever. I don't know what their situation is. I don't really remember.
But I mean, they're both elves. So they're both basically women. So I feel like your analysis is falling apart there.
I hear what you're saying, Trevor, but like even within the metaphor, you need to have things that are realistic and you need to have things that are like fantastic. Okay. And I think we can all agree that like an unaccompanied lady like riding around on a horse is just, it's like, it's lewd.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
I'm doing a really bad job at our feminist podcast. Like, I don't know how to feminist with Tolkien.
I know. I mean, I feel like we set out with this project to try to, you know, actually talk about the female characters. And it feels like there's something about this series that makes it really hard to actually take women seriously. Neil, I think you had a theory about that.
It's as though they're aren't really any female characters of note whatsoever, as though the story is really only interested in this completely homosocial world where actually what matters more is the relationship between, you know, races, which are also all just versions of humans, and humans are just called men. Like that's all that matters.
I think you're forgetting there are racialized others. They're just horrifying and monstrous. Or Persians. They don't call them Persians, but I'm pretty sure that's what they're supposed to be, right?
But it's strange because it's not exactly an allegory, right? They are actually races in the story. I don't know what the deal is with fantasy using the word race as though it's a real thing, but I really wish that would stop.
If only we could write a letter to J.R.R. Tolkien in the past saying, this way in which you've essentialized race in your fantasy world, as though it is like a fundamental and unbridgeable difference between people. Like, that's actually a pretty damaging discourse.
Peter Jackson is still, like, alive and well and winning Oscars. Certainly not for the Hobbit trilogy, but whatever. We'll move on to that when we get to the Hobbit movies in this episode 400. But films are certainly, as I would say, maybe more guilty than the books, because the Uruk-hai are black-skinned men, right? So, like, the Uruk-hai actually vilify black masculinity, because you actually have that visual representation. So what might we say to Peter Jackson? Like, he might even listen to this podcast. Like, I don't know.
One sec, I have a great idea. We're going to collectively write a letter. Dear Peter
Jackson,
why
did you
make
such
a racist
movie?
Can
you please
not...
Oh, I think we're done.
I think we're done.
Sincerely, Tolkien female characters.
This does make me think about how those mirror universes and things in fiction are often really excessively masculinized. Mm-hmm. Like even the, you know, Spock has a goatee. Right?
Yeah. And what's amazing about that is the very, like, the idea that our universe isn't masculine enough.
Yeah.
And so they need to, like, ramp up the patriarchy in order to make it, like, more... like fantastic and unbelievable.
Yeah, that's so strange.
I think it's because, you know, even in this universe, men are uncomfortable with masculinity to some extent. So when they see a darker timeline, it's just even like worse. It's that's like more entrenched than what they already have to deal with.
That's really interesting, Trevor. As someone who like disavows all remnants of masculinity, it's not a thing that I would ever have observed. I just assume all masculinity is bad 100% of the time.
My theory is that this series is basically agnostic about the existence of women.
What do you mean?
It doesn't matter if there are female characters at all. I think actually, weirdly, the reading of it as being sort of homoerotic misogynist, I feel like is actually probably the most generous reading of the gender politics of it that you can do. And I understand it seems apparent that Peter Jackson is aware enough of that to create roles for female characters and female actresses. I mean, I don't really think it works 100%. I think basically, if these movies were more connected to our real world, that would come across as incredibly disturbing and strange. I think it's the allegorical mode that lets it get away with it.
Geez, Neil, I don't know. Like, that's really interesting. Are you suggesting that, like, women might be able to play, like, a stronger role in these kinds of stories?
I think what Neil might actually be suggesting is that the very structure of these kinds of stories are not welcome to women characters. That to some degree, trying to find a feminist reading of a series like this is just not productive, because this whole narrative was created to structurally exclude women.
God, I'd never really thought about it that way before. So, like, maybe there's something in the actual, like, form that is antagonistic to me, like, as a reader. Maybe I deserve more. Maybe I deserve, like, representation. And not just a Tolkien representation, am I right, ladies? Am I right?
By God, I think you are onto something!
have we done? What have we done? How could we read so blind? Listeners lost, where were we? Spoiled all, everything's gone all token. Have we done? What have we done? Cancel the podcast right now. In a million years, they'll find it. 12 episodes and a Twitter feed that reads, "Here lies poor Wish, please." We never imagined all these men. Never. And nobody here can see the problem.
How could they?
That all we ever wanted were some strong female characters. Why does patriarchy ruin everything? Well, what the heck? We did our Witch Please best, and probably no one else will even listen. That's true. And for a moment, why, we had a film degree guy who explained some interesting details to us. He did. And for the first time since we can't remember when, we felt just like our old witchy selves again. And we are the Witch Please hosts.
That's right.
We are the Witch Please hosts. Can't wait until 2016, cause we've got some new ideas that will extend the podcast run. And by God, we're really gonna give it all our might.
Uh-oh.
We hope there's still time to set things right.
That was perfect. I don't want to listen to it. I don't want to think about it again. It was perfect.
In honor of this very special, deeply surreal Witch Please holiday special, we're going to add one last segment, which I have titled Epic Wizard Rap Battle. In which we talk a little bit more and a little bit less ironically about why it is that we think that the Harry Potter series is so open to the kinds of conversations we want to have, and The Lord of the Rings seems to be, all parody aside, so resistant to the kind of reading that we thrive on.
And it's a question that we have been asked by the good people who have interviewed us in the past, but I'm really interested in hearing what Neil and Trevor have to say on the topic, because they've never had to answer that question.
That makes me think about the live show and how we were talking about how, without believing that Harry Potter is necessarily a feminist text, that it is hospitable to feminist readings, that it's possible to recuperate it in a feminist way without struggling against the overwhelming trend of the text. And I think when you look at Lord of the Rings, you can see what a text looks like that, not out of sloppiness or lack of thought, doesn't have that same ability to be looked at that way. So I think basically it's that the texts themselves have a different relationship to gender entirely, I would say. And I do think it's because Lord of the Rings is pretty obsessed with race to the exclusion of a lot of other things.
Yeah, I've never really thought about it. But, I mean, I'll just put it out there that Lord of the Rings was written by a man at the beginning of the 20th century, and Harry Potter was written by a woman after, you know, second wave feminism.
Always trying to distort things.
Harry Potter has women characters, so that makes it a lot more open to talking about women. I don't know. It's certainly structural in that sense.
I was thinking about that too, Trevor, and how, as much as I hate to essentialize, because I do think it's possible for women to write ludicrous misogynist drivel, and for men to write really well thought out, excellent feminist texts, there does seem to be something in the fact that, Tolkien is a man who wrote a book about men for men, and then J.K. Rowling wrote a book that is about a boy who becomes a man and interacts with women and girls. And, maybe there's something to that, but, I'm really reluctant to, make an essentialist argument that, women are just more likely to write women.
I mean, I don't think it's essential.
I don't think it's necessarily, as Trevor was saying on the other side of the room and so not on mic, I don't think it's necessarily an essentialist argument, which is women are socialized to actually see a much wider range of humans as human and to see a much wider range of the people that they encounter as possessing interesting subjectivity, whereas it's still possible for a male author today to say that he can't write women characters because he just doesn't understand women. Right? Which is just shocking bullshit because that's 50% of the human population and fuck you. You know, especially when, as Neil was saying earlier, especially when that's in fantasy, where it's like you can write space travel, but not women. Cool. Right? And so I think part of it is that, right? That somehow Tolkien can imagine this incredible fantasy world. He can construct multiple languages and multiple races, and he can't imagine a space in that world for women that isn't the domestic sphere, right? Mm-hmm. And that suggests to us, again, something of, you know, we think of a lot of the possibilities of fantasy and sci-fi as genres that can really radically imagine themselves out of their historical context. And then, as Marcel, as you well know, studying the history of this genre, all you have to do is look back at some of it and you're like, not doing a great job.
I mean, you don't even need to look back. You can just look at the really hostile male authors and male readership of contemporary sci-fi who are just so completely antagonistic to the idea that, SF as a genre should include more radical constructions of society in which, you know, gender may be different from what it is. And I think, I have never been able to make it all the way through the Lord of the Rings series. The book versions, obviously the movies are a completely different thing because I don't need to listen to what they are saying. They can just be on in the background. But for the books, I had to stop reading it because I just got so exhausted with the fact that the actual female characters don't play a significant role. And I know that Eowyn does go into battle and she does perform this really important task of killing the Witch King of Angmar. This is so embarrassing. When men talk about things that they haven't read, they're just like, yeah, that's what happened. You're like, and then you who have read it are like, oh, I feel like I remember it differently, but you must be right. Anyway, I'm correct. A man has told me that I am correct. So, so the fact that there's a single female character who plays that role demonstrates that it is possible to imagine it, but you can only imagine it in this realm, as an exception, you know? So Eowyn becomes the exception that proves the rule. She is the exception who goes out there into battle, survives, but only then to go back into the domestic. She is unique and special as opposed to women are capable of fighting in battles.
Yeah.
Well, that felt good.
Yeah, it did feel good.
Well, thank God we're back. And you know what? Just in time to say happy holidays to all of our favorite witches.
Are you ready? Could do making Christmas. Mother Fungus, Jordan Ruth, Q Rainbow, Warrior and Fun. Or it could be Mother Fungus, Jordan Ruth, Q Rainbow, Warrior and Fun. Last Nora, seen and heard Yake, another great etc.
You're doing this now.
Andrew Bretz, just confuses people. Paula Gabriella's, Pewter Wolf, their
13 caveats quorum. Aaron, Emily, Anne, Vivinya, Mar, Shameless Edmonton, Aurors. Destiny, Nicole, Zed, Taraf, Rachel, Big Eyes, Matt, Domville, Ephia, S, Indigo, Han, Holly, Dun Design, Jesse says, Spark, Lily, Smarakuya, Fibrous, Ruth, Udbookflow, Dot, Dear Alina, Mick Jack Joe, 1985, MW Boyce, Alicia Ardelian, Mystic Warrior, Sophie Bimlio, Coral Miss, Chelsea Chan, Guts Magazine, Zach, Alex Young, Physics Katie, Fritz Lasha, Janie Canuck, Katarina Hoven, The Mirage Child, Dasselge, Savannah Goyette, Lisa or Melissa, Kamalosh to you, Terps Delight, Maldalgleish, Nemo's Winter, Short to the Point, Proletarian, Arts, Katie Hasenbank, Broken Tape Deck, SM Arbuthnot, It's Just Roar, Emily Hoven, Liba Jen, and Karina Soros. You guys want to sing a chorus with me?
Sure.
Silver bells. Silver bells, it's holiday time in the city. Ring-a-ling, hear them ring. Soon it will be holiday time.
Beautiful.
I've internalized Christmas so deeply into my soul. Thank you all so much for joining us for our Witch Please holiday special. If you'd like to hear the rest of our episodes, you can find them at owitchplease.ca or subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. And please join us on Twitter at owitchplease. We love to hear from you. Also, as you may have noticed, there are some phenomenal songs in this episode that were adapted from very real songs written and composed by Danny Elfman from The Nightmare Before Christmas. If you would like to see our spectacular lyrical adaptations, we have posted the lyrics up on our blog, owitchplease.ca, so you can listen and sing along.
We'll be back in the new year with another episode of some variety. Who even knows what we do here now? But until then,
later, witches!
Sauron gets the ring of power, elves and humans all will cower, and woe will come to everyone. Nope. So now correct me if I'm wrong.
Nope, you wrote it. Why can't you sing it?
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.